The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
2 weeks ago, we had a sermon describing when the prophesied great tribulation will begin. The beginning of the end of the age is also designated as the moment that God will protect a number of people. We began by reading Revelation 12 and verse 14, and I will not have you turn there today because I'm just going to read just a part of a sentence that we had covered last week. And in that prophecy of the protection that God will offer, it uses the symbolism of a woman to portray the church of God. And it says that the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she will be nourished. Now that place is an unknown location. It's described as a wilderness in another scripture that we will not cover today, but we'll look at in the sermon after this. The place is poetically described as a garden, but not the kind of garden that one might think of, a garden that has beautiful roses growing and trimmed hedges and bountiful fruits and vegetables. The wilderness description regarding the place of safety refers to a location that is vastly uninhabited. Now, there may be natural vegetation and there may be even naturally growing produce available. We are not sure of exactly how it will be in that location, but there are several mentions of a wilderness in the scriptures, and all of them refer to remote locations where there are no cities, towns, villages, and very few, if any, abodes. Shelters might exist in such locations, but they would only consist of like tents or teepees or something similar. And so where this location is, this wilderness, where the woman will be nourished, cannot be known at this time. We can speculate about where it might be, and I have an opinion on it, but I'm not going to go into that because it is just purely speculation. But, nobody is going to know where that location is until it is inhabited by the woman. But the place of protection is really not important. What is worth considering is how God will protect certain people, how selected people will escape great tribulation. That is something that we should think about. And so let's go to Luke 21. That is going to be the topic for today's message in this second part of what will likely be three sermons. In the last sermon that we heard describing when the abomination of desolation occurs, it is a trigger we saw for the beginning of great tribulation. And Christ said that people who are in Judea, when they see this coming to pass, that they should flee immediately. And the instruction to hastily leave the area is because of war that will break out on several fronts. Luke quoted Christ to say in Luke 21 and verse 20, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her." So don't head in that direction. You're going to be in a world of trouble. "For these," it continues to say in verse 22, "for these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for obvious reasons, difficult travel, difficult time, hard times, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So we see a brief description of what will be a terrifying time when sects of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam all clash in a fight for this territory. You see, all will consider what the man of sin does blasphemous to the area that they all believe to be holy. And all will consider this to be against their beliefs, and they must try to do something about it. And so it's called a time of the Gentiles, because Gentiles, meaning either unbelievers and or ingenuine believers, they will be in full control of this area. Now, Herbert Armstrong pointed out in a radio message we had heard last week that a Gentile is a person that is not a true believer. This means that they could be Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, agnostic, atheist, or a number of different categories of religion. But one who truly believes keeps the commandments of Christ. They observe the holy days. They love God with all their heart. They love their neighbors as themselves. And they're no longer a Gentile then, no matter what their heritage. And the Apostle Paul wrote in Galatians 3:29, he said, "If you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." So it didn't matter if you were born from the tribe of Judah or Manasseh or Reuben or what have you. If you are Christ's, meaning if you keep Christ's commandments, as you live, as you strive to live as he lived, then you're considered a part of the seed of Abraham even. So those who were once not authentic believers, once Gentiles, were without Christ, but now in Christ Jesus, as the Apostle Paul again had written in Ephesians 2, you once were far off, but have been brought near. And so faithfulness to God in the way that he dictates removes the classification of being a Gentile and allows for us to become a part of the commonwealth of Israel. In other words, grafted in to the tribes of Israel. As Christ said of Nathanael, seeing him from a distance, being able to look right into his heart, he said, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile." And so, the time of the Gentiles will be a number of people in control of that area. Of course, the primary control will be from the empire that is under the leadership of the man of sin, also depicted as a beast. And something else, when it comes to the selective inclusion of people being protected during that great tribulation, is there should never be an emphasis at this time. We should never stress that, you know, we are with one congregation or another, that that is what is important. Because while most feel superior to others at this time, and perhaps always have, what is important is that we are on target with God's doctrine, how accurate we are in applying God's commandments. That is important. Now, it's true that some organizations are more on track than others, but the organization, regardless, the organization will not be a factor unless that organization affects our behavior in a negative way. Then it will matter. And so there are two primary eras of the church of God that exist in our age. We have the Philadelphian era and the era of Laodicea. There is an element of Sardis that still exists at this time as well, but the primary eras are Philadelphia and Laodicea. Now, most like to think that they are part of the Philadelphian era of the Church of God, being more faithful than all of the rest. However, in reality, most are actually Laodicean. That is the dominant era in our age, and we're going to talk about more about that later, not in this sermon, but we will come back to it. Go back a page or two to Luke 17. And so Christ said that when it's time to flee, don't go back to get anything. You know, don't go back to get your coat. Don't go back to get a can of beans. Don't go back to get a weapon, or don't go back to get your cell phone. That's what most people would think of today. Oh, my phone, I got to go back. How many times have we left the house and had to turn around and come back? I've done it a number of times. Had to turn around and come back and get your cell phone. But it wasn't a matter of urgency, so I had time to do it. In any case, Christ indicated that you need to get out while you can. And there are a few reasons for this. Let's look at this, Luke 17 and verse 31. Verse 31, where it says, "In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it." And so the reference to Lot's wife in this situation is telling. First, it does show us where our focus should be. Our focus should be on what God says that we should do, to trust God in all of this, and when we do, he will take care of our needs. And we're well aware of that concept about not being, you know, concerned for certain things when we are doing God's will and doing his work that he told people, don't worry about it. You know, look how God takes care of the birds and the grass and other things. You're more important than they are. He is going to take care of you. And so we need, the focus is God and what he desires for us to do in life. Now, when it comes to Lot's wife, we have an example of not needing to look back at what we are leaving behind. To look back wishing that we may have brought this or we may have brought that, or feeling a sense of, you know, we're going to miss what we left behind. We loved that lifestyle. We loved living there. This is going to be a heartbreak for us. But there's something else in the reference to Lot that reveals how God will protect certain people. And so let's go back a few verses in the same chapter, but Luke 17, and we're going to begin reading in verse 22. Where it says that Christ spoke to his disciples here, saying that the days will come when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say to you, look here, or look there. Do not go after them, or follow them. Now, some people like to say, well, he's talking directly to the disciples here, and he's telling the disciples at that time, if they say Christ is here or there, don't follow those people. But this is an enduring message here. This is talking about the end of the age. It's talking about events leading up to the end of the age. And so we have to see how that applies in our time. And so if they say to you, look here or look there, don't go after them or follow them. And then here comes some supernatural events. For as the lightning that flashes out of one part under heaven shines to the other part under heaven quickly, in a matter of a second or two, so also the Son of Man will be in his day. And now it's notable that he is not talking about his return to the Mount of Olives at this time. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, and they married wives. They were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot. Now here we have the example of Noah. People were going about their business, doing what they would, marrying, drinking, partying, whatever. And then, bang, it starts. Likewise, also in the days of Lot. This is verse 28. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. And so it is that we have this example of people just going about their business, not even aware really that this is going to begin, that this is going to happen, the beginning of the end for them. And the example given is the time of Noah and also the time of Lot. And then it goes down and says to remember Lot's wife. And so let's go back and look at a little bit of that in Genesis 19. Genesis chapter 19. We know that Sodom and other cities in this area were filled with sin before God destroyed them. It was so bad that God did not leave anything or anyone alive in those locations. He destroyed the entire city of Sodom and Gomorrah and also two other locations near to them, cities called Admah and Zeboim. Now, when God sent two angels to evaluate the situation in Sodom, it wasn't only to evaluate how bad it was. God sent these two angels for another reason. God would protect Lot and his family. He knew he would do this for the sake of Abraham, but also because of the enduring example that would be left in what he would do for Lot and his family. So when it came time to leave, these angels, we know the story, they came in, they met with Lot, they were harassed by people in the city, they spent the night, and the next morning it's time to leave, it's time to go, but Lot lingered. In Genesis 19 and verse 15, it says, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, meaning he didn't really want to go. He was taking his time and perhaps fiddling with this and that. Let me gather this. Let me grab that. You know, this is going to be important. But while he lingered, it says, the men, these two angels appearing to Lot and his family as men, took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, and the Eternal being merciful to him, they brought him out and set him outside the city. And so what we see that happened here is supernatural. This was a miracle, a deliverance that protected Lot and his family from what was coming. Now, some might try to argue what brought him out and set him outside the city actually means. They might say that, well, that it just means that they grabbed him by the hand and that they all quickly ran out of the city, outside the gates. But the definitions strongly suggest that Lot and his wife and his two daughters, that they did not run through the streets of the city and out of the gates. Time was of the essence here. They had to move, and they had to move quickly, quicker than one's feet could carry them. And so the angels took them out of harm's way, took them by the hand, and set them outside the city. Now, there are several other translations of this account that actually say that the angels placed Lot and his family outside the city. And in verse 17, it says, so it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains lest you be destroyed. So this was a miraculous transportation outside of the city boundaries, outside, but there was still a possibility to be harmed by the massive fire and brimstone that would be rained down on these locations. And so he said, you need to move now. And this supernatural event is a clue. It's a clue for us, because something like this happening to Lot and his family is not unique to Lot and his family. So we know, for example, we have the story of Enoch, and we see how Enoch was a righteous man. That's what it means when it says that he walked with God. He didn't literally walk with God side by side, but figuratively walked in righteousness, and God took him. He took him out of harm's way when evil was spreading in that area like a pandemic. It says that God took the body of Moses to an unknown location that was on the earth. Elijah was taken up into a whirlwind, but he did not go to be with God in heaven. No, he was placed or relocated to an area of Judah, where Elijah continued to serve as a prophet to the southern kingdom. And you can see in 2 Chronicles 21 that after he was removed, that here he is writing letters to the king of Judah from that area. In the New Testament, we have an example of the apostle Philip and how he was taken to a city, I think it's called Azotus, so I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it, but he was taken by God, miraculously, supernaturally moved from after baptizing a eunuch. Now, with all of these examples in mind, would it be far-fetched to say that God will take hundreds or even thousands of people from different parts of the world and remove them and take them to a place where they are protected? Well, it's not far-fetched. It's not only possible, there are actually several verses indicating that that is exactly what God is going to do. And we're going to look at just a few more of them in this message today. So let's go to Daniel 12. It's nice to be able to turn the mic off when I cough. Still have a lingering cough from being ill last week. That was a rough one. Okay, Daniel 12. So we had already read the prophecy of the woman in Revelation 12, portraying Christ's church, which is fitting, of course, portraying his church as a woman, because he is the bridegroom. The church is pictured as the bride that will literally become his bride. It pictures people that are being prepared spiritually, undefiled by false religion, being virgins in this way, having no guile, as it talks about Nathanael, being an Israelite indeed, and a number of qualities that people that are being developed, groomed, if you will, in the church to develop and to have, to be fit for their husband. Now, Revelation 12 and verse 14 that I had quoted says that she will fly into the wilderness to her place. Now, the term fly means to take flight. And something related to this is that it says she will be given wings of a great eagle. So the imagery is spectacular, but it does not mean that those people who are selected to be protected are going to sprout wings and fly away. It is symbolic. It is symbolic of supernatural protection. It refers actually to angelic assistance. So God has many angels that assist him in a variety of ways. There are 24 elders, there are four living creatures, there are cherubim, and an untold number of others, likely millions, even hundreds of billions of angels that he has created and that assist him in so many ways that we are not even aware of. Now, we are aware of some. We are aware that Christ said that he could call down 12 legions of angels if it were necessary. Occasionally, a particular angel is mentioned by name, and Gabriel and Michael are mentioned by name, and they appear to be significant angels. Michael is portrayed as a chief or prince of angels who commands other angels. And he is noted even in the book of Daniel to have fought against a spirit being that is called the Prince of Persia. And I'm sorry, that's not in the book of Daniel, but... oh, yes, it is. My mind is not working well nowadays. In any case, it says that Michael disputed with Satan about the body of Moses. That's shown in Jude chapter 9. And people wonder, well, what was the dispute about? Why would they fight about Moses' body? And it's because God had an angel take Moses' body and put it to a hidden location. But Satan's a spirit being. He knew exactly where the body was, and I think he wanted it. He wanted it so that it could be a place where people would come to worship the bones of Moses, which is why God removed Moses' body from the people of Israel, so that they would not worship Moses. And so in any case, Michael is a great angel, and it appears that he is going to be commanded by God to stand up and take some action here at the beginning of the end of the age, and likely in throughout the end of the age. And so in the book of Daniel, we have scriptures indicating how God will protect certain people. And we had read a portion of Daniel last week talking about the beginning of the end, the abomination of desolation, that, you know, it talks about the maneuvering and the battles between the king of the north and the king of the south, and also news coming from the east, which means other involvement in these battles people from other nations that will become involved in what will become a World War III. And so, after prophesying of events leading up to the abomination of desolation, it says in Daniel 12, over one more page, Daniel 12 and verse 1, it says, and again, if you look in verse 45 of verse 11 of chapter 11, talks about this, you know, the abomination here, and him placing a palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Talk about the Mediterranean and the Dead Seas and the holy mountain, referring to Jerusalem. And then it says in verse 1 of chapter 12, at that time Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as has never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And I believe the book, it's talking about a book of remembrance, not the book of life. And I'm not going to go into the book of remembrance, but the point of reading this is that we see Michael, he is a leader here among angels, and there are several examples we have in the Bible, in the book of Ezekiel, for example, and in the book of Revelation, of angels having the face of an eagle. Now, I believe that this is an indication of what is meant by the woman being given the wings of a great eagle. And Michael will be commanded to stand up at this time. In other words, he will be commanded to take action on behalf of the people that God will deliver from great tribulation. The worst time in human history, describes it here. Same description Christ used. Exodus 23, if you will. And so that tribulation, called Great Tribulation, begins with seven seals. Those seals that Christ began describing, the beginning of the end of the age in Matthew 24, those seals consist of satanic and demonic involvement, inspired war, plagues, and supernatural upheaval. Those whom God selects will need supernatural protection at that time when this begins. And so there is a parallel pattern to this scenario. You see, God brought Israel out of Egypt through plagues, miracles that took place in Egypt. And it says in Exodus 19 and verse 4 that he bore them on eagle's wings. But they did not fly, and they were not supernaturally transported from one location to another. We understand they walked. Nonetheless, that mode of travel that the Israelites took on the journey, it included supernatural assistance in multiple ways. I mean, they were miraculously brought out of Egypt. They were sustained as they walked for day and night for a period of weeks. They went through the Red Sea miraculously, and God took care of them for decades, actually, wandering in the wilderness. He took care of them. And we even have the example of saying their clothes and their shoes didn't even wear out. Can you imagine being able to wear a pair of shoes for 40 years in rough terrain? Yeah. And they didn't have Nikes. They didn't have Merrell. What is that ones we, the hiking shoes we have? Merrell? Yeah. Really good hiking shoe. But they would wear out after 40 years of, or long before 40 years, unless God was involved. And so they did have supernatural, miraculous things going on during the Exodus and afterward. And so the expression of them being saved or being taken out by eagle's wings, it refers to what? Angelic assistance. God had angels assisting them in this. In Exodus 23, in verse 20, it says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared." So an angel led them in the pillar of fire and of cloud. An angel is the one that brought the commandments to them. It was by direct command of God. Many miracles occurred for these people for 40 years and beyond. And they came at the hand of angels or an angel who were directed by God. Now, there's even evidence, and I'm not going to go into that now, but it's interesting conversation and to consider the evidence that Christ had in direct involvement in these affairs, and that in some locations where it refers to an angel leading them, or even, you know, speaking to Moses through the burning bush, that it was Christ. Let's go back, or I should say forward, to Matthew 24. Oh, too far. Matthew 24. It's my belief, and I am not alone, that the protection God will provide, the place of safety, this will be a miraculous extraction of selected individuals. The transportation will be supernatural, and it will be instantaneous, as Christ described, like lightning coming from the east to the west. Like that, it will happen. So there's not going to be a need for people to make sure that they are attending with a particular organization or to keep your eyes on certain ministers because They say, pay attention to what we're saying because we're going to be ones to tell you what to do and when it's time to flee. That will not be a factor. See, the prophecies speak of divine intervention. Now, notice the following verse where Christ is again addressing signs of the end of the age in Matthew 24 and verse 23. And this is another account of something that Luke and also Mark had documented, where it says, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Now, this description here, this warning, I should say, is not referring to the time when the Great Tribulation begins. You know, Christ indicates that this will be a time when God's people found in the church are able to go here or there, wherever they might want to travel. And so they would be able to go to the inner rooms. They would be able to go out to the desert, if need be. And the next verse shows why some people should not follow someone who says, let's go meet him. I know where he's at. Let's go. It's time to go. In verse 27, it says, for as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. And then an additional note, which is of great interest. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now, there are stages of Christ's return. There is one ultimate return where he will come and step down on the Mount of Olives. The mountain will split heave in two, and the beginning of God's kingdom on the earth will start at that time. But Christ will come before, but not in his full glory. He will come to the earth before God's kingdom is established on the earth. And this is one of those locations where he talks about his coming. And that is why some people get confused about this, because they think, well, he's talking about when he comes to the Mount of Olives. But that's not what is being mentioned here. And there's a sermon in our library, I believe, about it. I had given several years ago. I don't know how long ago, but I believe it's called Stages of Christ's Return or Christ's Coming, something to that effect. In any case, so what we have is another description of something supernatural, and it indicates that God is going to intervene and gather people to a certain location. And it's my belief that the depiction of a carcass here is a reference to Christ, that he will be at this location. He will appear at this location. And the reason the term carcass likely is used is because it is referring to him as a man being slain through crucifixion. Now, Matthew uses the term carcass, but Luke, in his depiction of this conversation, he says body. Of course, Christ would not appear to any human being in his full glory. We understand that he told Moses on Mount Sinai that you cannot see me in my full glory. You cannot see my face and live. The same would be for any human being. And so Christ would appear to people as a man. And think about this. When appearing to his disciples after his crucifixion and after his resurrection, he appeared to them as a man. And he even told Thomas, who doubted, to come and put his hands on the wounds. Put your finger in the hole where they drove the stakes. And he did, and Thomas believed. And so could it be that this will be a form that he will take when appearing to those who escape? It is possible. But it's also possible that that is simply the reason why those terms are used, carcass and body. So the reference to more than one eagle being gathered to this location, it says wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. And that's interesting, because in one location, in Revelation 12, the prophecy of showing us the image of a woman who is given great eagle wings, but then it says eagles will be gathered together, and that would be more than two wings. But instead of focusing on the number of wings being different, or even the number of eagles being different, we find similarities in the depiction of supernatural flight. And so what may be indicated is more than one angel being involved in the extraction. There has been much confusion in the religious community about people being protected at the end of the age. There are theories among Catholics and Protestants and Mormons and others about the protection that God is going to provide to certain people at that time. And many have adopted theories about a rapture of saints, a rapture that whisks believers into the clouds where they will remain there and be protected before the tribulation begins. That scenario is not true. What they have done is they have merged prophecies of people being protected with prophecies of a resurrection. Now, the term rapture, interestingly, it began to appear in the Latin Vulgate translation of the Bible in the 4th century, and that term was placed where the Apostle Paul's prophecy of saints being caught up together in the clouds was rendered as raptured. So they, instead of saying caught up, they say raptured. But Paul's prophecy was not about protection of people during the tribulation, and we understand it's a description of chosen saints that will be resurrected, that will be changed. Those who are dead in Christ will be raised from the dead. Those who are alive during that time will be caught up together with them, and they will meet Christ in the clouds. But not understanding what Paul was talking about, and not understanding God's plan of a first and better resurrection, not having the Spirit of God to guide them in their understanding of God's plan, this theory of a rapture was developed. And so all of God's people found throughout the various scattered groups existing at the end of the age, they will remain on the earth throughout most of the tribulation. And while the Scriptures do not validate rapture theories, what they do speak of is they do speak of individuals who have been less faithful, that they will have to endure or face the tribulation while others are protected. And the reason I mention that is because in these rapture theories, there is one side that emphasizes verses showing the church going through the tribulation, and another side points to passages depicting the church being protected during the tribulation. But both sides of the rapture theorists misinterpret a variety of verses, not having God's Spirit to guide them. And so the Scriptures foretell of protection, and they also foretell of an eventual resurrection of chosen saints that will occur when? At the last trump, talking about the seventh trumpet plague. But again, rapture theorists, they confuse these events, and they've created a doctrine based upon their misunderstanding. So for those who might consider some of what we have read about people so far anyway, people being taken to a place of safety, portraying, possibly thinking that, well, it's actually portraying a resurrection. There are several reasons why what we have covered so far is not a resurrection. And the first is the extraction of selected people, as we have read in the several accounts here. It occurs prior to the sixth seal consisting of heavenly signs. And Christ described the sixth seal as occurring when? Before the trumpet plagues and before, therefore, the first resurrection. So it's only after the tribulation has been going on for more than 3 years that the first resurrection will occur. In Matthew 24 and verse 29 this time, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And so we see there is a difference between what was said previously in Matthew 24, verses 27 through 28, when it comes to gathering people to a place of safety. The Savior describes himself as coming like lightning from the east to the west. And how does lightning appear? We've all seen it. Quickly, bang, suddenly. Once in a while, you get one of those amazing lightnings that seems to stick to the ground and strobe for just a second or two. It's frightening. It's something that really grabs your attention. It's quick, and it lasts only a few seconds. And so that is what Christ is talking about when people are gathered to be protected during the tribulation. It's something that will happen fast. It'll like being taken on the wings of an angelic eagle, moved quickly to a remote location. But the resurrection, it differs in that angels will gather the elect from the four winds, as it says, or four corners of the earth. And as Paul said, it will occur at the sound of the last trumpet, referring to the trumpet plagues. And that is when, as it says in Revelation 10 and verse 7, that the mystery of God would be finished. The plan that he has declared to his servants, the prophets, the hope of those people who are called today to be a part of that first and better resurrection. Luke chapter 17 Now, whether or not we understand that people will be taken to a place where they are protected, or we might think that people are going to walk to a place of safety, it's not a matter of salvation whether you believe one way or the other. But it could become a matter of salvation, a matter of being chosen for the first resurrection, if we think that we need to follow a minister who claims that God is going to tell him or his people what to do, and he's going to tell the congregation what to do, and then we're going to do exactly as that minister says. Because feeding his ego or their egos in this way, people might go along with other things that they tell people to do, things that are incorrect according to God's doctrine. And that could make a difference and whether we are chosen or not. A system in which ministers will be given a message from God and they will relate that message to the flock of what they need to do when it's time to flee, that might seem like something that is possible, but that scenario is not biblical. In fact, the opposite is true. Christ indicated that if someone tells you to go here or go there, that's where the carcass is going to be, he said, don't go. And Luke quoted Christ to say, this is Luke 17 and verse 23. Might as well read it since I'm here. I was going to read another scripture, but... And they will say to you, look here, look there. He said, do not go after them or follow them. Don't do it. Instead, the prophecies indicate that certain people will be taken, that they will be removed from harm's way and protected in a remote location where nobody can hurt them. In Luke 17, verse 34, it says, I tell you, in that night there will be two men in one bed. The one will be taken, the other will be left. Two women will be grinding together. The one will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field. The one will be taken and the other left. It's describing people in different areas, different parts of the world, where some will be taken, selected to be protected, and the other not. And by the way, just as an aside, this is the scripture condoning homosexuality. Two men in one bed. Some people might try to misuse that scripture, but it's just talking about two men, brothers, father, son, whatever, sleeping in the same location. Doesn't mean they're both going to go. So it's not going to be our decision whether we go or not. I mean, think about it. Think about it in this way. If it were up to us to decide if we're going to listen to somebody tell us to flee, and then we get to choose whether we are going to go or not, what would we do? What would most people do? What about the people that you love that are not being told to go? You're going to say, come on, let's go. Come with me. I was told. I have insight. It's time to go. We need to get out of here. We need to be protected from what is coming. And if you think about it, by the time people arrived, if they were all traveling by car or boat or plane or walking to these locations, by the time they arrived, how many stragglers would they have picked up along the way? People seeing groups that are going to a place to be kept safe, and people kind of putting scriptures together and not really sure, but you know what? I'm going to take my chances. I'm going with them. Because I would rather be protected with God's people than stay here and have to suffer the tribulation. I mean, you would, the location would end up swelling with hundreds of thousands, likely, of people showing up, many of which were not sincere or genuine in their faith. And there would be thousands just tagging along to see where this leads, to see what's going to happen here. But that is not how it's going to happen. Such an important decision is not going to be left up to people to decide. In fact, there are prophecies indicating that many people that are even affiliated with or a part of the Church of God, that they will not be taken. God is going to decide who will go. And the next time we're going to hear about some of the criteria that God will decide or use, that God will use to decide who will be taken and who will be left.